Thank you very much, Mina. It's great to be here to kick off spring, and I'm very happy to be giving you this talk. So there's a colloquium, and the audience is somewhat diverse, so I'm going to try to do that balancing act of not saying too much or too little about any of the topics I'll discuss, and so hopefully I end up satisfying everybody instead of nobody. But it's April Fool's Day, so if it's nobody, then, well, you know, happy April Fool's. Okay, so let's start very broad. So one of the world's most fascinating features to me is its dependence on scale. So we know that in the standard model, in quantum field theory, charges, coupling constants, even the number of spatial dimensions in certain models depend on how closely we look. And here on Earth, we see lots of structure. We see lots of substructure in the universe, which emerged from the quantum fluctuations that happened to take place in the early universe. And so things really do change as we zoom in and out. In quantum field theory, the scale dependence is encoded in the equations of their normalization group. So as we coarse grain, go to larger and larger scales, we go from the UV to the IR, and the RG equations tell us what happens when we do that. But not all theories flow. Conformal field theories, like this vegetable over here, are scale invariant, self-similar, and more precisely, they're invariant under the full conformal group. And so as fixed points of RG flow, CFTs are invaluable to the study of field theory in general. You can think of quantum field theories as massive deformations, irrelevant deformations of conformal field theories. I hardly have to justify this, I think, to this audience, but CFTs appear in the sky, in the lab, and in our minds. So the moment right now in quantum field theory is a very interesting one. I think we're witnessing dramatic change in our conceptions of quantum and conformal field theory, in particular what it means to define a theory. There are lots of new ideas about how to define CFTs, what is needed for that, and they tend not to rely on the familiar descriptions like Lagrangians or even indeed the need for quantum fields themselves. In this context, a lot of the progress has been driven by the conformal bootstrap, which is the program of classifying the space and properties of CFTs using symmetries and other abstract constraints that are fundamental to every theory. So schematically, the bootstrap aims to make pictures like this. So if we have some set of operators with conformal dimensions delta I and three-point coefficients Cijk, which encode their interactions, then we'd like to make a plot in theory space of what theories are allowed that are consistent with these symmetries and what theories are not, and for those that are allowed to understand what properties they must have and what the underlying structures are. So, for example, this orange region would denote the space of possible consistent theories, and the region outside of that is a set of theories that have been ruled out according to one or another such constraints. This is sometimes referred to as a swampland. That word takes various meanings depending on who you speak to, but generally speaking, it means something like this. So the bootstrap has three main prongs. The first is to classify the space of CFTs, as I just characterized. The second is to understand the properties of all CFTs. And the third is to understand the properties of a given universality class of CFTs. So given some assumptions about the theory, say some assumption on its symmetries or spectrum, what is the rest of the operator data that characterizes that theory? So you might be interested in some model that describes some set of excitations that you're interested in, like a 3D Ising model, for example, and to understand its critical exponents and so on. So a lot of the investigations in the world of the bootstrap were originally numerical, but now the analytics are really taking off. And what it means to bootstrap is a time-dependent statement as we discover new facts about field theory. For me, the thing that's most exciting about these developments is that they play a dual role, no pun intended, in the context of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which relates theories of quantum gravity and anti-de Sitter space to conformal field theories in one fewer dimension without gravity. So what is the basic picture here? So we know theories of gravity have their own requirements. You shouldn't be able to build a time machine if certain energy conditions are satisfied. There should be no negative energy excitations. They should be UV finite, et cetera. And so you can imagine trying to build a space of consistent theories of quantum gravity, as some of us try to do. And a basic statement about the ADS-CFT correspondence is just that these two spaces are, in some sense, mapping to each other. And understanding exactly how that mapping works is going to be profitable for both sides. So, for example, there are theories of gravity that are that emit a classical limit. Among those, there are theories that have a GR sector. And there are more complicated theories, like string theory, which have much more than just the graviton. And understanding to what kinds of field theories these map is an interesting question that has been looked into for a while, but is still not concluded, and likely won't be for some time. So we know that large N theories are dual to classical theories of gravity. Among those, when the coupling is strong, there is a GR subsector. And there's some class of CFTs which reflect the stringiness of the bulk dual in a way that is not entirely clear. So at the outset, ADS-CFT was mostly used in practice as a tool for understanding strongly coupled field theory dynamics, where, of course, there are no other simple tools available in general. So the arrow would sort of run this way, and I'll discuss some of the landmark results in that later on. But now, I think it's fair to say, in the past several years, the arrow is reversing in the sense that we are capable enough at harnessing the constraints of conformal symmetry without much else to understand very basic fundamental facts about gravity from them. So the arrow is now sort of turning this way, or rather, it's going both ways. And so making this precise and extracting the lessons from this is part of what my research is all about. So my work is guided by three core questions, which I'll talk about a bit throughout the talk. First, what is the space of consistent quantum field theories and theories of quantum gravity? Second, what are the underlying physical and functional structures of quantum gravitational scattering amplitudes and field theory correlation functions? And finally, can we construct string and M theory specifically within possible theories of quantum gravity by combining precision field theory computations with this holographic picture? So today's talk will be about some small aspect of these very sort of grandiose ambitions. So I'll be talking about both the spectrum and dynamics of ADS quantum gravity using field theory techniques. And within this, there will be a new idea that is meant as an alternative to perturbative string theory that uses these field theory methods in a way that I think is very promising. And so I'll try to emphasize throughout the scope of the conformal bootstrap ideal, such as it is, that is sort of constantly expanding. And some of the techniques I discuss will apply to any theory. Some will be specific to certain theories. But this is basically where we're going. So let's give a slightly more detailed outline. And before doing that, I should just emphasize that one unifying theme will be that the quantumness of the theory in the bulk, which is to say, working at finite G Newton or beyond the classical level, is something that these results will have in common. So first, I will talk a bit about the bootstrap in a little more detail. First, the traditional bootstrap, which uses crossing symmetry, and then what that's evolved into as analytic methods have developed. Then I'll put this in the context of holography. And first, we'll talk about what you can extract about the spectrum of the quantum gravitational theory. And then we'll move on to the dynamics. So in part three, I will give some discussion of some recent paper I was involved with that gives the bound state spectrum of 3D quantum gravity in ADS at finite G Newton. It's completely non-perturbative. Then we'll move on to the question about dynamics, which is to say scattering amplitudes in the bulk, which are dual to CFT correlators. And I'll talk about a new method that's been developed for the past few years about how to compute these using field theory methods, where the bulk calculations are quite hard and rather undeveloped. And then I'll transition to this thing I mentioned about applying this to string theory. And I'll close with some discussion of some of the big questions I think are interesting in this realm. And so it goes without saying, please ask as many questions as you like. Interrupt me at any time. Okay. Good. So what are conformal field theories? So from the perspective of the bootstrap, conformal field theories are lists of numbers. These numbers are the spectrum of local operators, which I'll call OI. have some set of local primary operators, which carry quantum numbers under the conformal group. So they have conformal dimensions, delta. They have some set of Lorentz spins and charges under any other global symmetries. And second of all, their interactions. So there are some three-point coefficients, Cijk, which are like structure constants in Lie algebra, just now generalized to some operator algebra formed by these O's. And this is known as the operator product expansion, where the product of two operators brought close together can be expanded as a sum of a third operator. So these data, delta I and Cijk, completely determine the local operator dynamics of a CFT. At this point, it's worth just stating the proviso that there are non-local aspects to field theories. There are non-local extended operators. And from the bootstrap perspective, so far, most of the attention's been on the local operator sector, which is extremely rich as it is. And I won't talk about anything but that today. So when we talk about charting theory space, what this means is to constrain these sets of dimensions and coefficients. And importantly, there's no reference to Lagrangians here. It's not important. Indeed, it's believed not to even be meaningful in general to ask what these operators are, quote unquote, made of. These are, if you like, the gauge invariant operators of the theory. And so we just are going to restrict ourselves to their study. And whether or not they come from some elementary fields is irrelevant for the sake of classifying and understanding this space. So we can glue these vertices together to make higher point correlators, like four-point functions. Four-point functions can be expanded in conformal partial waves, which are just a conformal generalization of the partial waves in, say, quantum mechanics. And the dynamical data here is what you sum over and what numbers are sitting at these vertices. And these four-point functions obey dynamical laws, which constrain this underlying data. So two of the most basic dynamical rules for this data let's just call them rules, not dynamical rules, are unitarity, which states that the dimensions of all operators are lower bounded by some delta star, which is d-dependent and always positive, or non-negative, I should say. It depends on the spin of the operator, but it's some number which is known from just conformal algebra and is positive. And the OPE coefficients should be real. So these are statements that seem natural enough. And second of all, the statement of associativity of the operator algebra is also natural from this sort of Lie algebraic analogy. So when you perform the OPE, it shouldn't depend on what order you do that. And this will be important when inserted inside of four-point functions. These aren't the only constraints. And as I noted, we're discovering more and more things that seem to be fundamental constraints that do not follow from these two constraints themselves. And I'll mention one briefly. So as I noted, inside four-point functions, associativity implies something called crossing symmetry, which is the statement that no matter which channel I expand a Euclidean four-point function in, the answer should be the same. So if I write it as a sum of conformal partial waves in the S channel versus the T channel, the result should be the same. And the essential power of this equation is that the partial waves themselves are not symmetric under this operation. So you have a sum of a bunch of things that aren't symmetric, and the whole thing has to be symmetric. Unitarity also plays an important role here. The coefficients in each of these expansions for a four-point function of identical operators, say, are positive. They're the squares of OPE coefficients, which are real. Okay. So this idea dates back some decades. But it was only recently shown, relatively recently shown, to be powerful enough in greater than two dimensions to actually learn something. So in 2D, various rational models were solved by using crossing symmetry of correlators. But in higher than two dimensions, basically nothing was shown with complete rigor until 2008. So here are some classic bootstrap questions. Is there an upper bound on the dimension of the lightest operator in any CFT? We know there are lower bounds from unitarity, but what about upper bounds? I can ask the same question in a given OPE of two operators. Are there bounds on OPE coefficients? So, for example, central charges are anomaly coefficients. If I assume certain features of the theory, say some set of symmetries, or that there's some number of relevant operators, is there a CFT at all with those features?
reason why you should expect that there is an upper bound? And if so, what does it mean? I mean, the lower bound is correlated with unitarity, so that's basic principle, let's call it. So what, can you imagine something?
So we know that there are upper bounds on the lightest operators. So this is not just a speculation. And as for what this means, so some of the intuition at a very coarse level comes from holography, which I'll sort of talk about in a bit. But even just putting that aside, you know, I think even if it doesn't follow from unitarity, crossing symmetry is just a restatement of associativity of the OPE, and so that also is some fundamental property of the theory. And if that's powerful enough to determine bounds like this, then you can view it as a statement about associativity. Also, well, yeah, I'm not sure, I mean, you know, as for why there should be such an upper bound, you know, that's a deep question. I guess I'll try to return to that later on. But I think that's part of, there's some surprise in some sense that the bootstrap is working as well as it is. And it's not completely understood why crossing symmetry is so powerful. I think related to that is the question that you asked. But I'll return to it in some fashion later. So of the CFTs, we know about how special are they. In other words, in theory space, do they somehow live on the boundary of the set of allowed theories, or otherwise near some feature? And finally, in a given CFT, what are the hidden structures that relate apparently independent OPE data? Is this really just a somewhat arbitrary list, or are these numbers correlated in some way that's not obvious after you read the big yellow book about CFT? So the crossing equations are functional equations. These four-point functions are functions of cross ratios. And there's an infinite set of operators you sum over. And each time you insert an operator, there's some OPE coefficients. So there's an infinite set of data for these equations, which depend on the cross ratios of the four-point function. So the solution is tough to find. And in general, requires some truncation, some approximation, or usually both. And so this is why numerics were used in the first stage of the bootstrap quite heavily. So let me just flash a couple sort of classic results here. This is from a paper from 2012, which looks at 3D CFTs in the universality class of the 3D Ising model. So there's some assumption about the number of relevant operators. And here is a plot of the dimensions of the sigma and epsilon operator. And what that means, what that really means is a bit misleading, is that there's a set of correlators that is studied. And this is a plot of the dimension of the lightest operators against each other. Okay. So there's nothing input here about the fact that you're studying 3D Ising. You're not. You're just studying universality class of models in which the 3D Ising is believed to live. And then you can ask, where is that in this plot? Okay. So studying the crossing equations for a single correlator produced this plot. The purple region is allowed so far. And the white region is rigorously excluded. So no field theories live here. And if you ask, where does the 3D Ising model live based on what we already know about it? It seems to live at this kink here. So this is from 2012. Now, upgrading the numerics and studying not just one correlator, but systems of correlators and imposing positivity on a whole matrix of four-point functions improves these results such that this becomes an island. I like to think of this as sea level rise in the conformal bootstrap. So there's a paper which studied 3D CFTs with ON symmetry for various values of N. And by improving these techniques, you get islands. So for the Ising model, this island on this scale, which you notice is much smaller than these scales, is tiny. And the O2 and O3 models have very small islands as well. Okay. So the dimensions of the first two operators have to be living inside these islands somewhere. And these islands may well shrink further as you get better and better with your numerics. Okay. So there was a paper with this plot, which was called the bootstrapping the ON archipelago. So there's a lot of puns that can be made involving climate change, but I'll just leave it at one for now. And so as I've emphasized, many interesting known CFTs seem to saturate bootstrap bounds, sit at kinks, or as things get better and better, sit inside of islands. Okay. So the idea is that the hope the possibility is that the islands sort of keep shrinking as you study these equations more and more precisely, such that maybe the theories we know about, like the 3D icing model, is, you know, sitting at a point. This is the sort of idealized version of what's going on here. This is a very favorable situation, and in lots of examples, say if you have some marginal coupling, you're going to have some line of fixed points or some larger region, which you can't make any smaller. But this is a good picture to keep in mind for what's generally going on in this world. So in the past 5 years especially, let's say 8 years, analytics have really taken off. So let me just list a few landmark results, and this will be one of the sort of text-heavier slides in the talk, but I think it's just useful to mention some of what's been established. So first of all, every CFT has an infinite number of primaries. You might have just thought a finite number of primaries was just fine. This is not the case. We'll return to this in a moment. Every 2D CFT has a lightest primary, which is indeed below a universal upper bound. That upper bound just depends on the central charge of the theory. CFTs with higher spin currents have correlators, which are those of free CFTs. Central charges, which are measures of degrees of freedom and or anomalies, are often bounded. So ratios of central charges can be bounded from above or below. And the number of degrees of freedom is sometimes required to be not just greater than zero, but greater than some number which is greater than zero. Okay. And finally, many classes of superconformal theories have soluble subsectors that are completely determined by a 2D chiral algebra or vertex operator algebra. This is one of the more formal entries in this list, but it's still a fascinating story where if you have a D-dimensional theory with some extra symmetry, there's actually an effective sector which is completely determined in terms of some 2D structure which is hiding inside. Some of these are proven using new approaches, not crossing symmetry. So for example, studying causality and analyticity has led to some of these results. Likewise, by studying the physics of four-point functions in the Regé limit, which is a certain Lorentzian kinematic limit of high energy. There are energy conditions that CFTs must obey. For example, you might have heard about the average null energy condition. That can lead to some of these results. And in two dimensions, modular invariance can be viewed as a form of symmetry, of crossing symmetry, that just applies to the partition function. And this result that I quoted here was derived first by Simeon Hellerman by using modular invariance of the partition function of a 2D CFT, not by using correlation functions. Okay, so numerical bootstrap typically expands in a Lorentzian neighborhood of the crossing symmetric point. So four-point functions in general depend on two cross ratios, I'm calling Z and Z bar. And in Euclidean kinematics, Z bar equals Z star. But you can take them to be independent variables and move away from this diagonal. And the numerics expand in this region. And a lot of analytic progress has come from deriving constraints in other areas of this square, not in Euclidean kinematics. So let me talk about one. This is known as the light cone limit. If you have four operators which are space-like separated, what you can do is you can take two of them to approach each other's light cone. And there's a strong result that follows from this, which applies for all CFTs in greater than two dimensions by combining this limit with crossing symmetry. And that result is the following. Given two local primaries, O1 and O2, there exists an infinite set of large spin composite primaries, which you can think of as O1, n powers of the Laplacian, L open derivatives to give spin L, and then followed by O2 schematically, with vanishing anomalous dimension at infinite spin. So the dimension of an operator like this is just its engineering dimension. The spin is asymptotically large. So you can think of this as a kind of generalized free field theory, where you have operators 1 and 2. And at large spin, you can just make a Fock space of composites, as if you're studying some free scalar field. But here, the dimensions of these operators can be anything. These are local operators in your CFT. So at large spin, CFTs contain a subsector, which is described by mean field theory, or generalized free field theory. And this was proven in late 2012 by these two groups. So let's make a plot of these trajectories of operators. So if you're just studying pure mean field theory, then here we have a plot of spin versus twist, which is defined as dimension minus spin. And because the dimensions of these mean field theory operators is just the engineering dimension. This plot is flat, right? You assume these trajectories are indexed by n, which is 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on, all the way up to infinity. And so a large spin, every CFT has trajectories of operators that look like this. And you can ask what happens when you go to finite spin. So as you perturb in the 1 over spin expansion, these trajectories move a little bit. There's a whole industry of studying what happens. This is called large spin perturbation theory. So these dimensions get tweaked a little bit by some inverse power of the spin. And there's an infinite expansion here, of which this is just the first term. And so now you can ask, OK, what about at finite spin, not just inverse powers in large spin? What happens to these trajectories? And is it even sensible to talk about trajectories in CFT? This is a statement about large spin, but at finite spin, does it even make sense to organize operators into neat families like this? And indeed, the answer is yes. This follows largely from a relatively recent paper by Simon Caron-Huo, which shows that there's a nice picture of what I'll call regular trajectories in CFTs in greater than 2 dimensions. So there are curves which asymptote to the operators of mean field theory, on which the local operators of the CFT live at integer values of the spin. So for example, at the even spins here, I've plotted where there would be some set of local operators. This trajectory here is the leading regular trajectory. It contains the operators of lightest twist, lightest dimension for a given spin. This always includes the stress tensor, which has twist d minus 2 in d dimensions and has spin 2. And so there are these lines, these trajectories, which interpolate between these operators. And a key result here is that these are analytic functions of spin. This follows from this so-called Lorentzian inversion formula derived by Caron-Huo, the explicit form of which I didn't think belonged in this talk. And there's some small caveat, which is that at very low spins, there are some non-analyticities that modify this picture. But above spin 1 in a general CFT, this is exactly how things look. So just to summarize, the statement is that every field theory has trajectories of operators which look like this. And so this is some statement about large spin universality, which can be extended down to finite spin and which unifies all these operators into some more rigid structure than is immediately apparent. Any questions about this?
So will some of those trajectory cross at some point?
So right, this is a slight caricature. The basic answer is no. OK. So we can try to build up these trajectories operator by operator by starting with mean field theory and asking what happens when I add other operators into the game. The existence of this large spin asymptotic just follows from the existence of the unit operator in the CFT. But then we can ask, if an operator O couples to O1 and O2, what is its contribution to the trajectories of these operators, which are the composites? These are known as double twist operators. I'll use that nomenclature occasionally. So in a large spin expansion, the answer was known from the original papers. The answer is that they decay like the twist of the operator, which appears in the OPE of 1 and 2. So back here, I said there's some decay with some number. That number is going to be the twist of the lowest twist operator in the CFT. And typically, that's the stress tensor. But there can be scalars which are below that bound. But typically, it's the stress tensor. Okay. So what happens at finite spin? Can we characterize the requirements of crossing symmetry on the contribution of the existence of this operator in the OPE to the double twist trajectories? So that question can be phrased in the following way. The operator coupling to O1 and O2 means that in the four-point function of 1, 1 goes to 2, 2, there's some operator O which appears in the intermediate channel. And if we want to understand its contribution to these trajectories, we have to express it in the cross channel and look for the propagation of the composites of 1 and 2 in this correlator. So there's some sum over spins, and I can write this as an integral over dimensions of some kernel, which just expresses the change of basis of this partial wave into partial waves in the other channel. So this K is known as the crossing kernel. And the answer, then, is that the data of these double twist operators are captured by the residues of this crossing kernel at the poles corresponding to the twists of these operators. So there's going to be a pole in this function. That means that it's a double twist operator, which is propagating here. And the residue gives us the anomalous dimension and OP coefficient of that operator. So this is just, again, some change of basis between partial waves and the two channels. And this crossing kernel, it should be said, is equivalent to the 6J symbol of the conformal group. So from what I understand on the internet, there was a talk here just last week that involved the 6J symbol. Is that true? All right, so it's amusing that it keeps appearing. So the definition of this function just is the same as it is in quantum mechanics. You're used to thinking about 3J symbols, which express the addition of two angular momenta. The 6J symbol is what you get when you express the two different ways of adding three angular momenta and taking their overlap. So just to sort of follow me in this picture, if I add momenta 1 and 2, they'll fuse onto some other momentum. And then if I add the third one to that, they'll fuse onto yet another one. But instead, I can add 2 and 3 first instead of 1 and 2. So if I do that, then they fuse onto another momentum, and I add the third one, and then they spit out the last one. And if I take the conformally invariant overlap of these two things, I get the 6J symbol, which is often represented as a tetrahedron. So in this paper, we computed these in 1, 2, and 4 dimensions. The low dimension calculations had already been done, in part by Matthias, who's in the audience. And in general, they're expressed in terms of 7F6 hypergeometric functions that, depending on your perspective, is great or terrible. But it's a closed form result, nevertheless. And this thing has poles at these twists of double twist operators, and it gives you a very efficient encoding of these trajectories. I'm introducing this in part because we'll generalize this in a moment in two-dimensional CFTs. So, good. So let me move on here. So now let's talk about the bootstrap and some of these ideas in the context of ADS-CFT and gravity. Are there any questions before I get into that? Okay. So I think some of us know a bit about holography, but let me just review some of the most elementary aspects because of the breadth of the audience. So in a field theory, if you have some operator O, then this is, in general, dual to an elementary field phi in ADS. Okay. So the correspondence is most natural for a large NCFT, a CFT with lots of degrees of freedom. And the operators O I'm talking about here are known as single trace operators. So if you had a gauge theory, they would just be trace F squared, for example, as opposed to products of traces. Okay. The stress tensor in the CFT is dual to the graviton. Natural enough. We can take composites of these single trace operators to make multi-traces. These are like the multi-twists that we just discussed. And in the bulk, these are dual to multi-particle states of the elementary fields in the bulk Lagrangian. Conformal dimensions map to masses. There's some dictionary that relates these two, just using the ADS asymptotics. For scalars, it's this. The central charge in the CFT maps to the Planck scale in the bulk. So in particular, the loop expansion in terms of G Newton in the bulk is a 1 over n expansion in the CFT. And a correlation function in the CFT maps to a scattering amplitude in the ADS spacetime. So these elements of the dictionary were understood back in 1999. Here are some of the most famous results that were extracted from the correspondence from ADS implications for CFT. Okay, so we know that by now, entanglement in strongly coupled large N theories obeys an area law, which is given by the Ryu-Takayanagi formula. There's some bulk surface whose area we compute. That gives us the entanglement. If you have a strongly coupled quark-gluon plasma, so to speak, so this doesn't have to be the actual one of QCD, but if you look at a more supersymmetric scenario and compute from gravity what the ratio of viscosity to entropy density is, you get some universal answer coming from the Einstein gravity sector, which is just 1 over 4 pi. And famously, this got closer to actual observations of the quark-gluon plasma in QCD than any other toy model. Anomalous dimensions in strongly coupled field theories can be seen to just follow from dimensional analysis of a bulk string theory, where if you have some string state whose mass is m string, then the dual conformal dimension just scales like some power of the coupling, which is large, a result which otherwise is very hard to imagine getting without extra crutches like supersymmetry. And finally, we learn that there's a huge landscape of non-Lagrangian CFTs we didn't even know about, which just follow from some brain constructions, say, in string theory. Now, a cynic who might think of ADS CFT as being sort of old hat, after viewing this slide and knowing about this correspondence for so long, so I'd say that, first of all, I just think it's an incredible idea that will continue to pay dividends, and it's already shown itself to have such breadth across areas of theoretical physics. And also, it will just continue to have application beyond HepTH. For example, as these two discoveries have clearly shown. So I think it's fun to look back at this slide from Juan Maldacena's 1998 strings talk. So here's his last slide. He lists open problems. Okay, so let's look at these. Quantizing strings on Ramon Maron backgrounds, well, we still can't really do that. Can we drop supersymmetry and just look at, say, pure Yang Mills with lesser and lesser amounts of supersymmetry and understand what the bulk dual is? We can't really do that. We don't know what the bulk dual of QCD is. Black holes, can we understand the ADS-CFT resolution of the black hole information paradox in a concrete quantitative way? There's been quite a bit of work on that, but I think it's still fair to say, no, we can't. And can we extend this to other backgrounds, like De Sitter? There, it's certainly not nearly on as rigorous ground as ADS-CFT. So these problems are all still outstanding, and there's plenty of reason to keep working. There's also plenty of reason for hope. So here's Juan's 16th slide. Yeah. I might and I would, yes. Indeed. But not to the level where I think he had in mind and that we'd all like. You know, if you in the ADS 5 times S5 case, you could prove all sorts of things if you could really do that. Solving the world sheet theory has not been done. In ADS 3, there's been some progress, largely by you. But no, I think that's still at least partially open. Yeah. So this is, he suggested maybe by strings 99, these will all be fixed. Maybe by strings 29, but okay. So as I said, there's plenty of optimism, reason for optimism. Here's his slide about ADS2. Okay, this was his slide about ADS2. But in the past few years, especially, there's been a lot of progress understanding what the physics of ADS2 means from the field theory's perspective. Here I have in mind everything related to SYK. And indeed, one of the insights was that actually pure ADS2 is kind of a phantom, and you should think about near ADS2 instead. Okay. Good. Okay. So now let's talk a bit more about understanding features of quantum gravity from CFT, which will be the thrust of the rest of this talk. Good. So now I'm going to talk about the bound state spectrum of 3D gravity. And so here we'll enter some newer calculations. And I've tried again to give the right amount of detail, but please stop if you'd like more or less detail. Okay. So the dictionary for everything we derived in the light cone limit follows from things I said before. So we were talking about the spectrum of double trace composites, and in the bulk, these are two particle bound states. So I have some field phi 1 and phi 2, and they're in some state with radial quantum number n and angular momentum l. So they're spinning around some common center in ADS. And they have some anomalous dimension, which is dual to a binding energy in ADS. And the large spin falloff we discussed, say due to the stress tensor coupling to these operators, is dual to the fact that the gravitational force falls off in the bulk. So if these two operators, these two fields, exchange a single graviton, that will affect the binding energy. And this is dual in the CFT to the effect of the stress tensor coupling on that anomalous dimension. So this was the picture in greater than two dimensions, and you might ask why this fails in 2D. So in 2D, the stress tensor and its composites all have zero twist. The stress tensor is a sum of holomorphic and anti-holomorphic currents, and the twist is zero. And so the large spin expansion breaks down because we said the leading large spin asymptotics are controlled by the twist of the stress tensor. So one has to resum the effect of all of these composites on the binding energies on the anomalous dimensions of these multi-particle states. So the question is, in CFT2, what do these double twist redshift trajectories look like? And in the bulk, what is the bound state spectrum of 3D quantum gravity in ADS? So the strategy here is to perform a 2D CFT computation of these trajectories at finite central charge, which maps to finite G Newton in the bulk, and to map the result to 3D gravity. So let me describe this result. This is based on a paper from a few months ago. We're going to be introducing something I call Virasoro mean field theory. This is the complete contribution to the composite operator data from this entire vacuum module. So the identity operator, but also T and all of its composites. This will be the 2D generalization of ordinary mean field theory in higher dimensions. In that case, you just have the unit operator. So here's the answer. Let's make a plot of the twist versus the central charge. So a large central charge, that corresponds to ignoring the stress tensor and just keeping the unit operator, and you should get mean field theory. So indeed, you're going to have an infinite set of trajectories at large C. But at finite C, these trajectories change, and they get cut off. So there's a finite number of discrete trajectories at any given value of the central charge. And then you hit twist C minus 1 over 12, and you get a continuum. This is the result of inverting the Virasoro vacuum block as opposed to the unit operator in the same way that the crossing kernel allowed us to read off the field theory data of mean field theory from the inversion of the unit operator. So what is the shape of the trajectories? When phrased correctly, the exact trajectories are extremely simple. So here I'll have to introduce a couple seemingly arbitrary, perhaps, definitions. So we're going to define the twist in terms of some parameters alpha and q, like so. Q itself is related to the central charge, like this, which in turn we can just rewrite q in terms of some variable b, b plus b inverse. Just, if you like, just take these as definitions. Who knows where they came from? And the spectrum of these discrete trajectories is given by the following set of momenta alpha, just the sum of alpha 1 plus alpha 2 plus some shift n times b, where n is a non-negative integer that's bounded above until you hit this continuum. So if you've studied 2D CFT, this parameterization is probably familiar, say from Liouville theory, or from studying the Coulomb gas or the linear dilaton. But here, this is just a parameterization I'm using for these trajectories, and I haven't specified anything about the theory. So for example, we can translate this condition into an anomalous twist, which is a function of C. So as you go to finite C, these curves go down, and the anomalous twist of this lowest trajectory, for example, is this very simple result, minus 4 times alpha 1 times alpha 2, where alpha 1 and alpha 2 are these momenta of the external operators O1 and O2, whose composites we're studying. So where does this come from? The computation uses the Virasoro crossing kernel, as opposed to the ordinary crossing kernel for global blocks. This was imputed in some heroic work by Ponceau and Teschner. And if we include operators besides the vacuum and its descendants, which is what we computed here, right, this is just coming from the Virasoro vacuum module, we can ask how these trajectories change further, exactly an analogy to the deformations of the mean field theory result in D dimensions. And what we find is that, in perfect analogy, the trajectories asymptote to this Virasoro mean field theory at large spin. So non-vacuum contributions, the existence of other operators in the CFT, changes these trajectories by some amount which falls off at large spin. So in this sense, this sector is a universal sector of every 2D CFT at large spin. There's a very nice, before we talk about what's very nice, so let's just make the comparison a little clearer in case all these ingredients are piling up. So in two dimensions, we have this Virasoro mean field theory, which plays the role of ordinary mean field theory in greater than two dimensions. Here we have this infinite tower of discrete composites. Instead, in two dimensions, there's a finite tower plus this continuum. In mean field theory, the twists add. In Virasoro mean field theory, these momenta alpha add. We extracted this from the crossing kernel for global conformal blocks. Here we did it for Virasoro conformal blocks. There's a large spin universality operating in both cases. And I should say that here, while we resummed the 1 over C effects to all orders from the stress tensor, in higher dimensions, This is impossible to do technically. It's also non-universal. So the dynamics of the stress tensor in greater than two dimensions depend on the theory. But the important thing about two dimensions is that there's a Virasoro algebra. And so T dynamics only depend on the central charge. These results have a nice interpretation in gravity that just follows immediately from the ADS-CFT dictionary. So if you have some Lagrangian with two scalar fields, there's going to be some bound states. What we've computed are their binding energies due to the all-order exchange of only gravitons. And we just translate the mass into the dimension, like so. G Newton is related to the central charge, which we wrote in terms of Q, like this. So we just take all these results and translate. And this gives us the two-particle spectrum of 3D quantum gravity. This is valid for finite central charge and for arbitrary masses of these particles. And the result incorporates this quantum gravitational back reaction in ADS3. So the fact that these momenta add instead of the masses means that there's an anomalous dimension, an anomalous energy, which we've computed exactly, and is negative, and takes a very simple form. You might ask, where did this continuum come from, and what does it mean? Well, there's a finite cutoff on this discrete tower, which you can think of as reflecting the fact that there's a black hole threshold in the bulk. So if you take two particles and you collide them, and they have sufficient masses and energies, it will make a black hole. And above that threshold, at least semi-classically, there's a continuum. And this feature of Virasoro mean field theory seems to reflect that. If you think of these particles as being semi-classical so that they have a mass which is much greater than 1, but much smaller than the Planck scale, then they back react to form conical defects, which have infinitesimal angles. And there's a very nice interpretation of this addition rule, because the defect angle is proportional to the momentum. And so this additivity of momenta is just the statement that if you take two massive particles and put them on top of each other, the total mass is just the sum of the two to leading order. So in retrospect, there was some nice expectation that we might have gotten this. But again, this result is valid for arbitrary momenta. So these particles can be arbitrarily light, and it's a completely quantum statement. OK, so that's that for the spectrum of 3D gravity. Any questions before we proceed?
Does the continuum persist even for finite C?
It does. But so Virasoro mean field theory is not a good CFT. It's just a universal sector of CFTs, and it's what you get just by assuming that only the Virasoro vacuum module couples to these two operators, O1 and O2. In a real theory, the spectrum is discrete. And so what the condition is on the CFT such that when you add up all of the contributions, it resolves this continuum is interesting, and we don't answer that here. But you can think of this continuum as being universal in the sense of large spin that I described earlier. And so it does not actually mean that there's something funny about the CFTs we're considering where they have a continuum. It's just an artifact of looking at some limited set of operator data. But this is the universal set of data. So it's kind of interesting and simultaneously confusing that it reflects this existence of black holes, because this is a result that is true for finite C. And yet only at large C do we really think of the black holes as forming a continuum.
If you include non-vacuum block, then that continuum will.
So if you include a single non-vacuum block, then it doesn't. And that's and we computed that too, and that was this large spin suppression we were able to read off from that result. But if you have an infinite set of non-vacuum blocks, which indeed every CFT, every irrational 2D CFT does, then they should all conspire to make the spectrum discrete. OK, so now let's turn to some dynamics. And I'll discuss a bit about some new approaches to computing ADS scattering amplitudes. And then I will close. Okay. So now we're in D dimensions. We can go to D dimensions. We can forget about Virasoro. So the bootstrap typically constrains CFT correlation functions, as we discussed. And because scattering amplitudes are dual to correlators, and the loop expansion in ADS is dual to the 1 over n expansion in the CFT, we can rewrite the expansion in 1 over n of a CFT correlator in terms of some bulk Feynman diagrams, otherwise known as Witten diagrams. Witten's great insight was that you draw a Feynman diagram and put a circle around it, and it's a new object. So the tree level diagrams in the bulk are the planar piece of the correlator. And the loop diagrams in the bulk give you non-planar corrections to that. So we know that S matrices are extremely rich structures. And there's an entire field of amplitudes that studies these. The moment you put a scattering amplitude in ADS, a lot of that structure, as far as we know, all that structure basically disappears. And the tools that have been developed are no longer applicable. What are the beautiful underlying structures of curved space scattering amplitudes? ADS and DS seem like natural places to start because they're maximally symmetric. And of course, in the ADS case, we have this dual interpretation, which helps us out. But ultimately, it'd be nice to think about this question more generally, for example, in the context of cosmology. The philosophy of what I'll do here is to just try to mimic or be inspired by some of what's going on for S matrices. So at tree level, I won't really go into that because, well, it's quite a bit known and it's an interesting story. For example, if you have some ADS exchange amplitude, we'd like to rewrite this in terms of a sum over conformal partial waves because that's what we do in CFT to collect the constraints of symmetry into one nice object. And so we know by now what is the bulk dual of a conformal partial wave. It is something that we dubbed a geodesic Witten diagram, which is like an ordinary exchange Witten diagram, except these vertices are integrated only over pairs of geodesics connecting the boundary points. So there's sort of a term-by-term match here. And in cases where you have extra structure in the bulk, say if you have a supergravity, then there's a lot known. Many complete tree-level amplitudes are known. And this is just sort of a general picture for how you decompose a single amplitude. So there's much more work than I can properly cite here. This is a collection of some of the most important. So much less is known about loop level. Okay, so let's take these diagrams we compute in grad school, QFT, and put them in ADS. It turns out that this diagram, until relatively recently, was computed, but these were not. This is a bit dispiriting because this is just perturbation theory, and so we'd like to be able to say we understand ADS-CFT non-perturbatively, but actually, even in perturbation theory, our knowledge is quite limited. So in the world of amplitudes, the dominant paradigm is that of unitarity methods, which can roughly be thought of as generalizations of the optical theorem, which tells you that the unitarity of the S matrix implies that the discontinuity of an amplitude is given by the square of that amplitude. So as a picture, if you take a one-loop box diagram, you can compute this by slicing it in half and gluing together these two trees. And you can see from this relation that it buys you one order in perturbation theory. So I think that's clear. And that's what this picture is expressing. So the unitarity method is the idea that you can construct loop-level amplitudes from lower-order ones by cutting and gluing. And the philosophy is really just that once someone hands you a Lagrangian and you compute the tree-level amplitudes, those are essentially equivalent to taking the classical Lagrangian and constructing the amplitudes. So from those, you should be able to construct all the loop-level amplitudes just by working with the tree-level ones and being smart about how you compose them. So in ADS, is there some analogy of this? Well, first of all, because it has a boundary, there's no real notion of in and out asymptotic states. But instead, you have CFT operators, and what you're computing is a CFT correlator. So let's phrase the analog of this in the language of field theory. So I and others introduced something I'll call the ADS unitarity method, which is a prescription for constructing loop-level ADS amplitudes by taking OPE data of the lower-order ones in the dual CFT and gluing it together appropriately. The reason this can't be computed directly in the bulk very easily is just because the structure of these propagators is complicated in space-time. So you can write down as an integral what this thing is, but these are hypergeometric functions, and the integral is hard. Okay. So instead, what we do is we go to the dual CFT, we take the tree-level amplitudes we know, and we figure out how to glue them together to make the loops. So this is basically what I just said. And this gluing takes place in the coefficients of the partial wave decomposition. So let me draw a picture for what's going on. If we imagine a scalar coupled to gravity, we have this box diagram. So this is a two-rung ladder with gravitons being exchanged. Then schematically, you'd like to be able to split this and take a product of the trees here. And indeed, you can do this in a rigorous way. So, good. So for the sake of time, and time-wise, I have about 6 minutes or so. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, definitely. Because we started a bit late, so you definitely have time.
Great. Okay. So, good. So there's some nice mathematical connections here. And so I should say that with the CFT tool in hand, we've been able to return to the bulk and actually discover purely bulk methods for deconstructing these diagrams. So we now understand exactly what it means to cut a propagator. And in the world of unitarity methods for S matrices, cutting means taking internal propagators and putting them on shell. And now we know a rigorous way to do that in ADS. So this procedure, where we take this and sort of split it like that, can be thought of as a way to cut. To glue things together is to reconstruct the full amplitude from its cuts, which is also something we're understanding how to do better. This is work in progress. And I should also say that the transcendentality of a diagram in space-time can be read off from these kinds of cutting rules. There's a nice relationship between these three facets. And so these diagrams I showed before are diagrams that we can now compute using these methods. So now, finally, this application is string perturbation theory. What is it? So let's set up the issue. So one of the most beautiful aspects of string and M theory is that they predict corrections to general relativity in the low energy limit. So if you don't care about anything else about the theories, at the very least, you'd like to know what are the leading corrections to GR. So an experimentalist who has great power might like to test this and ask what these corrections are. And the sad truth is that we don't really know very much about them. So in M theory, for example, there's the Einstein term. And there are subleading terms with coefficients I'm suppressing. And these terms are known. So these are quartic and the Riemann curvature. But these terms are not. We don't even know which terms appear. In other words, we don't know whether they have coefficient 0 or not 0. And if they're not 0, we don't know what the coefficients are. In string theory, it's similar. There's a richer structure here. There are functions of the string coupling, not just constants. These terms are known. And beyond this, they're not known. This reflects a paucity of results in the scattering amplitudes of the theory. So in string perturbation theory, the state of the art is stops at three loops. So at three loops, the leading term at low energies is known, but higher order terms are not, and higher loop terms are not. Okay, and so talking to people in that community, they seem a little bit stuck about how to proceed technically. And in M theory, perturbation theory is not terribly well defined, because if you don't have a string amplitude to compare to when you dimensionally reduce to resolve ambiguities in computing 11D amplitudes, then there's no way to unambiguously determine the result. So the philosophy here uses the methods that I tried to articulate before. Imagine that you can holographically compute a loop-level amplitude in a theory with a string theory dual. Then you can take the limit where the ADS curvature goes to infinity and recover the string amplitude in flat space. I should say that there are no strings in this calculation. Part of what appeals to me about it is that we're taking a one of Wren expansion of CFT, which is going to be smooth and which doesn't involve strings or any of the tricky issues associated with strings, and translating that into the loop expansion of a string theory using this basic element of the ADS CFT dictionary. So the prototypical CFT with which to do this is this 4D maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. This has an ADS 5 times S5 dual. So it's a cross product between, a direct product rather, between the ADS space and an internal sphere. So what do? We compute the leading non-planar correction to a four-point function in n equals 4 super Yang-Mills in the limit of strong coupling. So we do an inverse expansion in 1 over lambda, where lambda is the Tuff coupling. And the bulk just maps to this following diagrammatic sum. Okay, so here's the supergravity piece, and there are stringy corrections in the bulk, which are suppressed by powers of 1 over lambda in the CFT. So we use our CFT method for computing these diagrams, and then we translate it to ADS, and we take the flat space limit of these amplitudes, which is a certain kinematic operation you do on these. And this reproduces, term by term, several of the first low-lying orders in string perturbation theory. So we know the result of genus 1. This is just a proof of principle that one can try to do this at higher orders and access things that we don't know which are hard to motivate, are extremely important for the ontological status of string theory. Okay, so hopefully this has conveyed some of the flavor of what's possible by combining bootstrap methods with holography. Let me just close by mentioning a few directions which I'd like to pursue, which I think will be very fruitful. So in the realm of computing observables in CFT using analytic methods, forgetting about holography, there's plenty to do. We'd like to understand new fundamental constraints that transcend just crossing symmetry. Some of this has been done. There's much more to be learned, I think. Can every CFT question be phrased in this abstract bootstrap language? For example, if a CFT has an anomaly, can you see that in the OPE data? And finally, can we probe typicality in the CFT landscape? So what do I mean by that? So the bootstrap makes plots like this, as we discussed. It excludes regions. But it doesn't definitively say that CFTs exist, or in the regions where they may exist, how likely it is that they actually do exist. So can we make a plot like this, where this is a region where CFTs are known to exist, and there are more CFTs here, say, than out here? Think of this as a contour map of theory space. So the question is, can we make this contour map? Can we give existence proofs, or some kind of more physics-y proof for the existence of CFTs using some relatively limited set of abstract constraints? For example, by studying infinite sets of correlators, or something that I can't yet imagine. This would be extremely interesting, because then you can make more concrete contact with systems in the lab, which may not have very much symmetry. And you can try to give at least a statistical argument for the existence of a theory with such and such properties, not just a hope that it may exist and hasn't yet been ruled out. And finally, in the context of ADS-CFT, well, there's a ton to do. I think it's an extremely interesting time. You can try to resum loop amplitudes to all orders. This is a sort of ladders with arbitrary rungs. This is something that I'm working on resumming. This is something we discussed a bit already. There's much more to do to go to higher genus and discover things we don't already know. And you can also try to bootstrap the ADS landscape within string theory. This is a question tailor-made for the bootstrap. And so you can try to ask, for example, in string compactifications that involve ADS spaces and some extra dimensions, are there bounds on what the shapes and sizes of these extra dimensions are? Can you constrain the dimensionality of spacetime, in other words, in the ADS-CFT correspondence? This is very recent progress. The answer is yes. It's not ready to go live, but I'm happy to discuss it, and I'm quite excited about it. So let me just close with some final thoughts. I think the tools for correlators in CFT and QFT that we're developing will have extremely broad use to the extent that field theory appears in physics, which of course it does everywhere. And in the string and M theory context, I think it's vitally important to compute these most basic observables using whatever tools we have, and I hope that this will be one of the tools. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Given that this is a colloquium, are there any questions from students? Are there any questions in general?
So the same way that in two dimensions you have the Virasoro algebra putting together many primaries, mm-hmm. quasi-primaries, you have these families of large spin. Can be those families, so these are families of conformal primaries. Can they be grouped together beyond that observation? I mean, is there some emergent symmetry or what do you make of the fact that you have families of primaries?
Yeah, it's a nice question. I think the answer is no, at least in the most straightforward sense in which you'd like to understand that. So because the shape of these trajectories at finite spin depends on the details of the theory, it seems unlikely that there's actually a symmetry that you can always associate to these trajectories. However, I mean, one case where we understand that there's a symmetry unifying operators of different spin is in free theories, where there's an emergent exact higher spin symmetry. But for an interacting CFT, I'm not sure that the answer will be yes. But there perhaps is a milder statement to be made that there's not a proper symmetry, but that maybe in some sense that is not exact, you can try to approximate these trajectories.
So a lattice field, that's probably happening.
Yeah, so but I think the power of this would be at finite spin, because I mean that's where the notion of trajectory is really coming into play. I mean, if you're always working at an asymptotically large spin, then you don't see everything down here. And that of course is especially theory dependent, it's true. But that's I think what we'd like to understand most. So I'm not sure, but maybe if you make further assumptions about the theory, besides that where it's not quite free, but perhaps it has some other structure, some other symmetry on the level of the Lagrangian, say, then maybe something special happens. But I'm pessimistic in general. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is vague, but can I think that eventually you'll be able to combine the constraints on the size of the extra dimensions with the computation of the expansion of correct in terms of the Einstein-Hilbert action to give people that are trying hard to measure gravitational waves and then extract things out of it coefficients to shoot for eventually LIGO 21st to try and pin those parameters and see if they are consistent with what nature has in store?
Yes, I think those two endeavors definitely talk to each other. So one of the reasons I think it's important to try to nail down these higher derivative corrections is that if you want to constrain the landscape of vacua beyond just the leading order Einstein level or supergravity level, you need to know these terms if you want to know that something is a solution. And I think we've been hampered by not knowing a lot about these theories, especially non-perturbatively. And those solutions that exist, say, you know, KKLT, there's plenty of controversy about whether they are legitimate or not. And the controversy stems from the fact that we don't have great control over these terms. So non-perturbatively, it'd be great to know the answers. But even perturbatively, that's where we should start. And indeed, those two things are closely related.
Can I ask, maybe this is too... I guess he was asking more of an observational. So naively, you would expect that these art of the fourth terms are suppressed by whatever string scale to some power.
Mm-hmm.
Could they have, is there a regime where they have measurable effects at a scale where we measure black holes at?
There's certainly a dream.
Yeah, I know, for everyone, I think, but is there something more concrete than that you could say?
I wish, but I think that's extremely attractive and important problem, but that's a tough one.
What about terms the terms that you presented also depend on what you were saying that the coefficients are fixed by supersymmetry.
Yes, that's why we know them.
Yeah. So the question is, supersymmetry is broken in nature.
Mm-hmm.
What do people have any idea what terms to expect and how they are suppressed by the scale of Susie versus the string scale?
Well,
how do you deviate from those terms?
Right. So. What's relevant there is that if you start with the superstring action, that's in 10D. And if you imagine trying to find a compactification down to 4D, then the details of the internal manifold are important. So if the manifold is small enough, then it can give you large corrections to the effective couplings of the 4D theory. So since it's the 4D scale, it's important. Even if the 10D terms are suppressed by some very small scale, you can get enhancement. And that's why I think it's important to understand whether you can have compactifications where the internal manifold is small, because it tells you information about the hierarchies that you're allowed to have in four dimensions.
Could you have, the cutoff of the theory cannot be smaller than some very high scale, TV scale, or something like that. Is there a way to make these operators suppressed by the KK scale, which can be much, much lower than that?
I think... So this is something that, a version of that question is one that I'm trying to answer in the ADS context.
Mm-hmm.
If you have Minkowski compactifications, then I think the answer should be yes. But you know, the sky's the limit for what, I don't think it's very well explored what is possible. Trying to get a better analytic handle on that is part of the motivation for doing this. Now, using ADS, in that context, ADS is just a crutch to help us understand. But actually, now we're better at taking flat space limits of ADS observables to relate to flat space physics. And so that actually wasn't so true in the first round, so to speak, of understanding ADS compactifications. So you actually hope that there's more direct contact between the ADS results and flat space results. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the discussion in the literature recently about the swampland and what's allowed and what's not allowed is focused on just questions related to what you're asking. And that's motivating me to tackle this from this ADS-CFT perspective. But ultimately, applying it to that is something that I'd love to do.
Have any more questions? Not, let's thank Eric again.